Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today we'll hear a talk from Wendell Potter, who, after a 20-year career as a corporate public relations executive, left his job as head of communications for one of the nation's largest health insurers to try his hand at helping socially responsible organizations, including those advocating for meaningful healthcare reform, achieve their goals. He spoke recently before a meeting of the Healthcare for Maine Alliance at the Maple Hill Farm Inn in Hollowell. This program will be archived online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can access this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Joseph Dautre, the founding executive director of Consumers for Affordable Healthcare.
So good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for being here. And thank you to all the steering committee members of the Healthcare for Maine Alliance. You've done a tremendous job in bringing people together and all of your efforts to inform people about the various healthcare reforms, both positive and negative, as well as the need for people to take action. I would like you also to thank Mitchell Stein, who's been sort of the coordinator for all of the work to get this conference together. I want to introduce you to a special person who we've invited here today to be your keynote speaker. And Wendell Potter is quite a distinguished person, and let me just tell you a little bit about him. I met Wendell at one of the National Association of Insurance Commissioner conferences, and Wendell, as was I, were consumer representatives to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And I don't know if you're familiar with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, but when they meet, about 1,800 to about 2,000 insurance industry representatives get together to basically affect insurance regulation. And Wendell and I were two of the 17 consumer representatives at these conferences. To basically represent the position of consumers. So that was my first experience in meeting Wendell. I learned more about Wendell as he has made appearances here in Maine, but a little bit about his background. Wendell started out as a journalist in Tennessee. He was born and raised in Tennessee. He was a journalist in Memphis and in Nashville. He was a journalist in Washington, D.C., and he wrote for Scripps, which is now Scripps Howard, news service, and he covered Congress and the White House and the Supreme Court. Wendell went on to work for as the chief communications officer for Cigna Healthcare, and got an inside view of Cigna Healthcare, I believe, for about 15 years as their communications coordinator. He's going to tell you a little bit more about the efforts of the insurance industry and their communications. He also worked as the public relations director for Humana, Inc., for about 4 or 5 years. So he's about 19 years of experience of working on the inside and understanding the strategies that the insurance industry use in order to very often to change regulations in their favor or to defeat insurance reform. He has spoken here in Maine before, and he has spoken at, for example, in front of the courthouse when Anthem was appealing the superintendent's decision to basically deny them a profit margin. And now Wendell is a senior analyst for the Center for Public Integrity, and he, which is affiliated with the Center for Media and Democracy. And he writes, he blogs. His writings and his articles are picked up by the Huffington Post. And so here's a man with tremendous experience, with tremendous heart, and he's here to help us all understand how to better communicate in these challenging times with all of the distractions and all of the misrepresentations and all of the myths that are being perpetuated by the insurance industry through the spin tanks that they set up in various states to basically distract and misinform people. He's here to tell us about the Affordable Care Act and the benefits that it provides, and to help us to understand how to talk about it in a way that people that you talk to every day will understand. So without further ado, please welcome Wendell Potter.
Thanks very much, Mitchell. Thank you, Joe, for that great introduction. Thank you all for being here today, and thanks for all you do. Regardless of our age, the color of our skin, or even who we voted for in the last election, just about every one of us are, or eventually will be, a victim of a healthcare system that has gotten completely out of whack. So much so that it has become not only the most expensive healthcare system on the planet, but it's also one of the most irrational and unfair. It's a system that, as you'll see, I think, during the coming few minutes, is simply not sustainable, which is why healthcare transformation is critical for the future of our country. Continuing with our current healthcare system, in my view, will actually bankrupt America and many families as well. I want to make a couple of things clear before I go on. First, although I'll be speaking candidly about what I learned and what I did when I was in the insurance industry, I'm not here to point fingers or to lay blame as to who's responsible for our broken healthcare system. Frankly, there wouldn't be enough time to do that anyway. But rather, I'm here to focus on and advocate for a new and improved healthcare system that will strengthen our country economically and at the same time provide every American with access to care that will strengthen them as individuals. America can only be as strong, folks, as its people. And if our people, if our population continues to get weaker and sicker, we're in trouble. Second, I'm not a politician, and I'm not partisan either. I voted for both Republicans and Democrats over the years, and I've been critical of politicians on both sides of the aisle. I'm a middle-class American, and I'm an independent thinker. What I am determined to do is work with fellow Americans who care about finding effective solutions to our healthcare crisis, regardless of any political affiliations they might have. Third, I'm a realist. The current healthcare system will never reform itself. There are just too many entrenched special interests that profit from the way that things are. A doctor friend of mine refuses to even call what we have in this country a system. He describes it as a sickness industry. That's because we've allowed special interests and big corporations to make huge profits off of us when we get sick. When you look at this industry from the outside, you'll find that it's the fastest growing industry in America, generating $2.6 trillion for a lot of companies and individuals who are doing quite well financially. There are few incentives for the healthcare industry to change. This is why change must come from the outside, from employers, governments, families, and individuals who are the ultimate payers for healthcare services. And that's why I've dedicated my life to finding other like-minded individuals and business owners who are ready to stand up and say, enough is enough. And that's why I'm here today. Don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-business by any means. I'm a capitalist, and no one, I don't think, would ever mistake me for a Marxist. I've owned stock in a lot of companies. I actually have been an owner of a small business. And I know my way around Wall Street. But during my two decades as a corporate executive, I learned that there's a lot more money to be made treating people after they get sick than in keeping them from getting sick in the first place. And I learned that although big insurance companies have proved to be incapable of controlling costs and expanding coverage, they nonetheless have gotten so big and so powerful that they now determine in many cases who has access to care and who doesn't. In a very real sense, Wall Street has shaped our so-called system for us. And unfortunately, we're now experiencing the effects of that Wall Street takeover of healthcare. An article in the September edition of Health Affairs found that a decade of healthcare increases cost increases has really wiped out real income gains for the American family. To quote from that article, healthcare costs affect a family's bottom line in four major ways. Two are visible: the monthly premiums the family pays for its share of the cost of private health insurance, and out-of-pocket spending for copayments, deductibles, prescriptions and over-the-counter medications, medical equipment, and in many instances, vision and dental care. The other two costs of health care are largely hidden. The employer's share of the family's premium for private health insurance, which in effect reduces employee wages and thus dampens family income, and the not inconsequential portion of the family's federal and state tax burden that's devoted to public health programs, including Medicare and Medicaid, the military system, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Indian Health Service. That article backs up what we saw with Sally and her family. Both premiums and medical care are becoming vastly more expensive while household incomes are dropping. Our sickness industry is failing more and more Americans every year, and we're paying a big economic price for that fact. For most of my career, though, I didn't want you to believe that. It was my job to make you believe that we have the best healthcare system in the world, and to make you believe that health insurance companies could fix whatever problems might exist, like controlling costs and getting more people insured. I was part of a big ongoing effort to mislead you so thoroughly that you wouldn't even consider supporting any kind of healthcare proposal that might hurt health insurance profits. I was not always in the business of misleading and obscuring, as Joe noted. In my first career, I was a newspaper reporter, and I tried to do the exact opposite of what I found myself doing later in my career. When I was a reporter, I considered it my ethical obligation to find the truth and to report it to the best of my ability. Eventually, though, I found my way into public relations, and I had a very successful second career doing things from time to time that I would have considered flat-out wrong when I was a journalist. I spent almost two decades as a PR executive for two of America's largest insurance companies, Humana and Cigna. In 2001, I became head of corporate communications at Cigna. For several years, I was at the top of my game as a PR professional, but in 2007, everything changed for me. That year, I'd been writing a policy paper that would be used by the insurance industry and its allies to try to convince people that the problem of Americans without health insurance wasn't that much of a problem after all. I intimated that many of the uninsured had chosen to shirk their responsibility to themselves and to their families. It was their problem, not society's. I'm sure you're probably familiar with this point of view. If you're uninsured, there's no one to blame but yourself. In July of 2007, as I was writing that paper, I visited my parents in East Tennessee. During that trip, I came across a newspaper story about something called a healthcare expedition that was being held a few miles across the state line at the Wise County Fairgrounds in Southwest Virginia. The story said that thousands of people were expected to travel from as far away as Georgia and Ohio to this three-day event to get care from doctors and nurses and other caregivers who were volunteering their time. So I decided to go take a look because, after all, I was writing a paper about these people and it was my job to be curious. I drove up to Wise County early the next morning. And folks, that 50-mile stretch of highway between Kingsport, Tennessee and Wise County, Virginia, turned out to be my road to Damascus. Nothing, I don't think, could have prepared me for what I saw when I got there. In fact, I know I wouldn't be here tonight or today had I not made that journey. And as it turned out, it was also a spiritual journey for me and one that changed my life. When I got there, the parking lot was jam-packed, and many people were still in their cars and their trucks because they had slept in them overnight and sometimes for a couple of nights. When the fairground gates opened at 6 o'clock, the place began to look like a refugee camp in a war zone. Enormous lines of people, soaking wet from the rain that had been falling that morning, stretched literally out of view. As I walked around, I noticed that some of those lines led to barns and animal stalls and tents where doctors and nurses were treating patients. These are the animal stalls. Except for the curtains that served as makeshift doors on those animal stalls, there was virtually no privacy. Remember, folks, this was 21st century America. It certainly didn't feel that way to me. That day, I realized that the people in those lines and in those stalls and in that barn were no different from me. They could have been my relatives or my former neighbors. They just had not had the good fortune to land a high-paying job like I had. It was clear to me at that moment that I was having an epiphany, which I never would have thought would happen to me. The commandment, love thy neighbor as thyself, suddenly popped into my head. Those people were indeed my neighbors. Until that day, though, I hadn't even thought of them as human beings. To me, they had been numbers on the Census Bureau spreadsheet and hardly anything more. But when I came face to face with them, they were no longer just numbers, and they never could be again. I knew I could not in good conscience continue to serving as a spokesman for the insurance industry. That's because I understood then and there that I was part of the problem. I realized that the profit obsession of the industry that I worked for was one of the main reasons those folks at the fairgrounds had to go to such lengths to get basic medical care. It was not their fault. A few days before, I had literally been writing these people off. I had allowed myself to believe my industry's characterization of them as irresponsible. And I could not have been more wrong. These people were not irresponsible. Our healthcare system had left them behind. They simply could not afford to get the care that they needed. I discovered later that 2/3 of the 4,000 people there that weekend had jobs. Most worked for small businesses that couldn't afford to provide coverage to their employees. Many of them had tried to buy policies on their own, but like millions of Americans who tried to buy their own coverage, had been turned down because of pre-existing conditions or for other reasons. Others had their policies canceled when they needed them most, when they got sick. So a few months later, I quit my job. I know now that I've found my real calling, which is to try to explain to people just how broken our healthcare system really is, how vulnerable we all are to joining the ranks of the uninsured, and how urgent it is to fix what's broken, to transform our sickness industry into a true system of care. By the way, the guy who organizes the healthcare expeditions like the one I visited is an Englishman named Stan Brock. In 1985, Stan Brock founded Remote Area Medical to fly doctors to remote areas in third world countries. It never occurred to him back in 1995 that most of his healthcare expeditions would eventually be in the United States, and not just in places like Wise County, Virginia, but in Chicago and Los Angeles and other big cities. Every year, Remote Area Medical helps tens of thousands of uninsured and underinsured Americans get care that they otherwise couldn't afford. But as you can see here, that's just a drop in the ocean, and the water level is rising. Ladies and gentlemen, as I said earlier, enough is enough. America is known as one of the most compassionate countries in the world. Yet 50 million of our citizens are unable to get access to care that they need. Millions more can't afford to pay their copays for basic health care services. If the health care industry is not willing to reform itself, then what can we do to turn things around? For most of the time that I worked in the health care industry, I believed that the best way to turn things around was for the government to, frankly, get the hell out of the way. I was a true believer in the notion that the free market could work just as effectively in health care as in any other sector of the economy. Although toward the end of my career, I was seeing firsthand what insurers and other companies will do to make sure that their directors and their stockholders are happy. And then I made that fateful trip to Wise County, and a few months later, I had to serve as spokesman for a company that denied coverage for a liver transplant that might have saved the life of a beautiful 17-year-old girl in Los Angeles. Nadalene Sarkeesian's doctors believed that she had a better than even chance of leaving the hospital alive and leading a normal life if she could get a new liver. Her parents were optimistic. A perfect match had been found, and her doctors were preparing for surgery. We'll never know if Nataline would have lived because Cigna notified those doctors just hours before the surgery that it would not pay for the transplant. A Cigna medical director who had never examined Nataline, just looked at some medical records, said he didn't think that the transplant would be appropriate for her. It became such a highly publicized case that a few days later, Cigna agreed to cover it. But the company's change of heart came too late. 5 days before Christmas in 2007, Nataline died. And so did any desire that I had to continue working for the insurance industry. Soon after Nataline's grief-stricken parents laid her to rest, I not only walked away from a high-paying job, I began to speak out about how health insurance companies really operate. The first time I did, as it turns out, was before Congress. That's me testifying to the Senate Commerce Committee on June the 24th, 2009. My job then, as today, was to explain how executives of insurance companies really think. These companies have grown to be enormously rich monopolies with one driving obsession, and that's to make as much money as possible for their executives and their shareholders. Now, that might be okay if you're Apple and you make things like this cool iPhone here, but insurance companies don't make anything nearly as cool as that, and in fact, they don't make anything at all. But they've grown to be enormous monopolies that, for all practical purposes, comprise now a cartel in this country, a cartel that has assumed the power to determine who lives and who dies in this country. If you have to seek medical care, you're not a patient to these companies, you're an expense. As I explained to Congress, insurers have come up with ways to help keep the sick and the needy off of their books and off of their balance sheets. One of their methods is called rescission. That's a common practice in which health insurance bureaucrats try to toss you out on a technicality, playing gotcha with your life. Congress had heard about this practice just a few weeks before I testified. A woman from Texas told about getting a notice the day before she was scheduled to have her mastectomy that she was no longer insured. Why? Because she had failed to mention being treated for a bout of acne the year before. Yes, acne. Another way insurers refuse or avoid paying claims is by dumping small businesses whose employees' medical claims are higher than expected. The insurance companies call this purging. One illness among employees at a small business is the only reason that an insurance company needs to jack up the next year's premium so high in many cases that the employer has to stop offering coverage, leaving all the workers and their families uninsured. This routine purging helps explain why the number of small businesses offering benefits to their employees has fallen so rapidly over the past several years. In addition to dumping policyholders they don't want, insurers refuse to sell coverage to people who have pre-existing conditions, including children like Sally and kids born with birth defects. Pre-existing conditions in the eyes of insurance companies range from illnesses like diabetes and cancer and heart problems to things like asthma and allergies. Another way insurance companies are keeping their directors and Wall Street happy is by shifting more and more of the cost of care from them to us. At least 25 million Americans are now underinsured because they've been shifted into plans with such limited benefits or high deductibles that they have to pay far more out of their own pockets than their family budgets often will allow. In a high deductible plan, as you probably know, you have to pay up to several thousand dollars before your insurance company will pick up a dime of your medical costs. And when your insurance company does eventually pay, you still have copayments and the fear that a treatment or procedure that your doctor says you need won't be covered. Folks, I've met people who are now in plans with $50,000 annual family deductibles. And those folks pray every night that they won't get sick. If you don't remember anything else from our time together, please remember this. Almost every one of us in this country are just a layoff or a rescission away from losing our coverage, and more of us are being priced out of the health insurance market or are having to buy inadequate coverage because of the constant pressure that our insurance companies are under from Wall Street to increase their profits. Access to decent health care is becoming available to fewer and fewer Americans every day. But you don't have to take my word for it. The effects of this disastrous state of affairs is they're pretty plain to see. Let's take a look at two useful measures of a population's overall health. First, life expectancy. According to the CIA, the U.S. ranks 50th in the world in terms of life expectancy. Now let's look at infant mortality. We rank 33rd, just ahead of countries like Romania and Mexico. Here's another fact. The U.S. has some of the best healthcare professionals and the best hospitals and the best medical schools in the world. I don't know anyone who would dispute that. So why do we score so poorly in these basic measures of national health and well-being? Because their so-called system is not working. Here's another revealing measure. According to the World Health Organization, the U.S. ranks 54th in the world in terms of fairness. That's a measure to the extent to which the best health care is available equally to a country's citizens. That's behind countries like Bangladesh and Tanzania. And then there's this shameful statistic. 45,000 Americans die every year because they don't have access to care that they need. That doesn't happen in any other developed country on the planet, and it certainly wouldn't happen here if we really did have the best healthcare system in the world. Americans spend a lot more money per capita than the next country, with the highest spending per capita, yet our health outcomes, like life expectancy, are not even in the top 10. This clearly indicates that much of America's healthcare spending is not contributing to improved health. That's the big picture. Now let's take a look at what the worsening state of this sickness industry is doing to families and individuals. One reason the number of uninsured Americans is climbing is the decreasing number of people with employment-based coverage. As we saw with Sally's mom, Maria, more and more small businesses are being priced out of providing health care coverage to their employees. And most of the job growth that we have is in small businesses. A second reason is that fewer people can afford to pay their share of the premiums, even if their employer subsidizes them. As we saw, real incomes have fallen over the past decade while premiums have skyrocketed. If all that weren't bad enough, insurers are now making us pay more for medical care out of our own pockets, as I said, even if we do have coverage. To accomplish this, insurance companies have been moving more and more of us into these high deductible plans that I mentioned. Now let's combine those higher deductibles with the increasing cost of premiums. Total health care costs, premiums plus deductibles, for a family of four have doubled in less than a decade, from a little over $9,000 in 2002 to more than $19,000 in 2011. And folks, when you're underinsured, when your deductible becomes too expensive, you'll often go without the care that you need, just like families who are uninsured. It's gotten so bad that now an estimated one in three Americans, one out of every three of us, are not getting the care or the medicines that they need because of the cost. Worse, about 700,000 of our neighbors file for bankruptcy annually because of medical debt. And a lot of those have health insurance. Folks, that doesn't happen in any other developed country in the world. It's quite simply a mess that we've got. It is not the best healthcare system in the world by a long shot. The reason I spent all this time explaining the economics of our healthcare system is because few people I've found understand just how expensive, how inequitable, and how inefficient our system has become, and why we really couldn't wait any longer to begin to transform it. Last year, as you know, the Congress passed the Affordable Care Act, and like every other attempt at healthcare reform over the past century, it met with strong opposition, just as they have done since Republican President Theodore Roosevelt first proposed reform more than 100 years ago. Since then, special interests have used fear, lies, and misdirection to try to stop any reform from happening, or at least the parts that they didn't like. But unlike past attempts, this time we got some reform enacted. Now the special interests are behind a well-financed campaign of misinformation to make us believe that the law is not in our best interest. That explains, folks, why polls show that support for the law has eroded. But don't be fooled. Their objective is not outright repeal of the law. What they really want is to strip out the consumer protections that require them to treat us the way we deserve to be treated. We have all heard some terrible things about the Affordable Care Act. So before we look at the changes that it really has brought, I'd like to quickly address some of the misinformation. Probably the most infamous myth is that the act has created death panels of government bureaucrats who will decide when people on Medicare will have to die. The origins of this myth lie in the provision from early versions of the bill that would have allowed Medicare to reimburse doctors for taking the time to help patients and their families make important and the best decisions about end-of-life care. This was about doctors helping their patients with difficult decisions, hardly the death panels conjured up by the fearmongers. The death panels, of course, do exist in this country. They're just not in Medicare or anywhere else in our government. They're deep inside our health insurance companies. If you don't believe me, just ask Madeline Sarkeesian's family. The next big myth is that the act cuts Medicare benefits. In fact, thanks to the new law, Medicare is now paying for preventive care, including important screenings like mammograms, for the very first time. And as we'll see shortly, the law is also helping people on Medicare pay for their prescriptions. I'm sure you've heard that the new law is a job killer and that it will hurt small businesses in particular. Well, that's more misinformation. In fact, the law helps small businesses compete with large companies for talented workers by giving them some tax breaks for the first time if they offer subsidized coverage to their employees. Another myth I'm almost certain that you've heard is that the government is now taking over health care. Raise your hands if you have heard the Affordable Care Act described as a government takeover of health care. Well, folks, back when I was in the insurance industry, my colleagues and I came up with that term to scare the heck out of people, just like the term socialized medicine does, which is another invention of the special interest. We wanted you to believe that any reform that might hurt our company's profits would be a government takeover of health care. And judging by the hands I just saw, I think we did an outstanding job of making you believe something that is absolutely not true. What is true is that we have had a Wall Street takeover of health care while we were not paying attention. And that, my friends, is what really should scare the heck out of us. I know what I'm talking about here. Remember, when I was an insurance company flack, it was my job to spread these kinds of myths, these lies. So what effect will last year's legislation have on the average family? Let's take a look.
Here are the Johnsons again. Things are looking up for this family now, and all because of the health care reform law passed by Congress in 2010. Take Sally. Thanks to the new law, her family doesn't have to worry about finding a policy for her. Insurance companies can no longer refuse to sell coverage for children with pre-existing conditions, as they have done for many years. In 2014, the law will also apply to adults. Maria has had some good news recently, too. Her employer will start offering health insurance next month. That's because it is now eligible for the tax credit the Affordable Care Act makes available to small businesses to help them pay for their employees' premiums. It should help them attract talented workers who in the past have opted for big companies over small ones because of health insurance. As for Daniel, well, he's been invited for a second interview for a job he really wants, and he could be leaving home very soon. His parents couldn't be happier. But even if this job opportunity falls through, thanks to the new law, Daniel is now covered by his family's policy until he reaches 26. Lastly, let's see how Henry and Charlotte are doing. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, they don't have to pay so much out of their own pockets. The donut hole in the Medicare program is shrinking, and so is the cost of their medications. The act will make that gap a thing of the past in a few years. Sally and her family have shown us just a few of the ways the Affordable Care Act is already helping millions of fellow Americans, including, I'm willing to bet, people you know and care about, maybe even you yourself.
As the Johnsons illustrate, last year our country took a big step toward fixing what's broken about our health care system. The Affordable Care Act already has made many of the worst anti-consumer practices of the insurance industry a thing of the past, and it'll eventually extend coverage to 30 million uninsured people if it's implemented as Congress intended. As important as that is, 20 million of us will still be left without insurance, so we've still got a lot of work to do. The Affordable Care Act isn't perfect. I often refer to it as the end of the beginning of reform. But repealing it and starting over is not a prudent way to move forward, in my view. It took us 100 years to get this far. If the law is repealed, there's not a snowball's chance that Congress could agree on any other decent bill anytime in the foreseeable future, probably not in my lifetime. As flawed and inadequate as the reform bill is, it's already begun saving the lives of thousands of our neighbors all across this country. But there are other things that we must do in the years ahead. We'll have to keep looking for new ways to reduce the cost of care. And we'll have to figure out how we can eventually get everybody covered, like every other developed country in the world. We'll need to encourage more medical students to go into primary care. And lawmakers should think creatively about how we can protect doctors from meritless lawsuits while also protecting the rights of people who become victims of medical malpractice. Reducing the cost of care is certainly achievable. Despite the huge shortcomings of our sickness industry, our government still spends more on health care as a percentage of GDP than any other country in the developed world. I've included some of these, I've included the same figure here for the United Kingdom, which has a nationalized healthcare system, as you probably know, yet still manages to spend proportionally less than half the amount that we do. Medicare alone could save billions of dollars every year simply through better coordination of patient care and in how doctors and hospitals are reimbursed. The government's enormous healthcare budget could go a lot further. But whatever path we take toward more comprehensive reform, we're going to come up against the same opponents and the same tactics. I know from personal experience that the insurance industry, drug companies, hospital chains, medical device manufacturers, doctor organizations, and a much longer list of other special interests, they will do whatever it takes to try to block or repeal any reforms that might threaten their profits or their income. I trust you'll agree it was high time that we told them that they needed to start treating us the way they would want us to treat them if we were in charge. Which brings me to this graph. It shows you that our healthcare system, our sickness industry, is not failing all of us after all. Among the biggest beneficiaries of our healthcare system, as you can see, are the health insurance companies. Even though their executives have failed miserably at controlling healthcare costs and have overseen a huge increase in the number of uninsured and underinsured Americans. Notice that their most profitable years have been during the recent recession, when millions of Americans lost their jobs, their homes, and their health insurance. How have they done this? How have they been able to achieve these kinds of earnings? Well, here's a partial list. They have refused to sell coverage to people who really need it, including children. They've canceled policies when they didn't want to pay for expensive care. They've purged small businesses from their roles when workers or their children got sick. They've charged women more than men and even refused to sell coverage to women at all for no reason other than the fact that they were women. They've been able to do all of this because we believed their lies and we allowed them and their masters on Wall Street to take charge of our health care system. We allowed them to get so big and so powerful that they now get to decide who has access to affordable care and who doesn't. We allowed them to set up and operate death panels to decide, in many cases, who lives and who dies. Folks, how many of you want to be treated this way? How many of you think this is the moral way to conduct business? These practices are just a few that have made it possible for the CEOs of health insurance companies to rank among the top paid executives in this country. In fact, UnitedHealthcare CEO Stephen J. Hemsley is now the highest paid CEO in America. As you'll see from this Forbes list of the highest paid executives, he hauled in more than $100 million last year. That's just one man. Collectively, the top executives of U.S. insurance companies make billions of dollars. I don't begrudge anyone a good paycheck, but those guys really deserve to make that kind of money, especially when their companies do what they do to earn a profit, and when an estimated 45,000 of our neighbors die every year because they're uninsured because of these companies' policies. Now, to be fair, these companies have done a great job of doing just what they are supposed to do, which is to make money for the shareholders. So I guess we really shouldn't begrudge them that either. While they failed miserably at controlling costs and bringing more people into coverage, that's not what they're in business to do. They're in business to make money, ladies and gentlemen, and at that they have been wildly successful. I hope the information I've shared with you this afternoon makes it clear where we were headed without reform. What passes for a healthcare system in this country is simply not sustainable. We're already suffering the economic and personal consequences of that increasingly expensive and dysfunctional system. One of the main reasons why family incomes have been falling is because our employers have been spending money that ordinarily they would have given us in raises to cover the constant increases in health insurance premiums. The money that workers should have received has gone instead into the pockets of people like Stephen J. Hemsley and his fellow CEOs. Our current system is also robbing us of jobs. Do you know that General Motors spends more on healthcare than on steel? You know, it's no wonder that GM is having a hard time competing with companies like Honda and Toyota. And speaking of Toyota, do you know why that company recently decided to build a new factory in Canada rather than in the places in the U.S. it had been looking at? Because paying healthcare premiums of U.S. workers would have meant that Toyota would have had to charge more for its cars than if Canadians made them. That's one big reason why job growth in this country is almost non-existent. I hope I've helped you understand why the reforms enacted last year were so necessary and why we still need to do a lot more to truly transform our system. The Affordable Care Act is far from perfect, as I said, but I think it's a strong start, and it's already making a real difference in the lives of people like us all across America. I hope that we can build on that together so that one day soon those scenes that you saw and that I saw at Wise County are a thing of the past. I'll end by summing up what I believe is one of the most important things I have to say to you or any other audience. We must love our neighbors as ourselves, even the uninsured ones. And we must treat them as we would want them to treat us if our roles were reversed. Yeah, that's the golden rule. Which is at the heart of the Judeo-Christian tradition, but it's also at the heart of all the world's major religions. If we commit to truly living by the golden rule, we, as Americans, can move the mountains that selfish special interests have put in place that keep millions of our neighbors from getting the care that they need and deserve, and that is holding our country back from economic growth and prosperity. When we move those mountains, we'll be able to transform our sickness industry into a true system of care. And while we're at it, we'll also be able to strengthen our economy and our people. Many of you are ready to help, but I'm sure you're asking, what can I do as a single individual to help bring transformation to a $2.6 trillion industry that controls 18% of the American economy? Step one is to understand that the root cause of our problem is a healthcare industry in which up to 50% of healthcare costs do not contribute to improved health outcomes. Step two is to investigate how you can help make a difference in your own community and in your own state. While healthcare reform at the national level may be bogged down in politics, and I'm sure it will be for years to come, there are things that you can do in your own community, and I know you all are doing it here in Maine, that can help facilitate more immediate healthcare transformation. I encourage you to find other like-minded individuals, to recruit people to work with you, and to start looking for ways to reform healthcare at the state and local level. Many state governments are finding new and improved ways to provide affordable care to the uninsured and to Medicaid beneficiaries. I don't think Maine is among them, but I think you need to begin to try to change that to make sure that Maine does join other states that truly are. Find out what your state is doing now and look for ways that you can help. You really need to pay attention to what's going on in Augusta. You can make a difference, and so can I. One of my goals is to set up a website in the coming months to share success stories that across America, as individuals like you join together to transform healthcare in America, one community and one state at a time. As Margaret Mead said, and I'm sure you've heard this, never underestimate the power of a small group of committed people to change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has. With that, I'm going to open it up to the floor and try to answer any questions you might have. Thank you very much. Ask Wendell. Part of the thing that I'm doing as a journalist, I've got this, this Center for Public Integrity encouraged me to take questions from people who are having trouble getting insurance or having trouble with their insurance company, and I'm trying to help. Once a week I write a column that is based on those questions. So you can tweet questions to me if you'd like, so please do. Yeah, back there.
Thank you. I love what you had to say. I also agree with Alice. But one of the things that I think has to happen, which has been so effective by the forces aligned against this, is a single message. Mm-hmm. And that's where I see the advocacy groups kind of falling apart.
Right.
And so I'm glad to hear that you are trying to help the groups do that. And I guess my plea is that we have one single message. I mean, I was appalled when the president sort of just dismissed universal health care. If you don't have something on the left, you start out in the middle and then you move everything.
I agree with you.
And really, I think most people would want universal health care. I mean, all of us want what the Congress has, and they have government-sponsored universal health care that's really good. And that's what I think we need, is some kind of message that, you know, give us what you have or whatever it is, but everybody's saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Because I think that people's experience is horrible. Everybody knows that the healthcare industry doesn't care about their health. But nobody has one thing that we can sort of get behind with the simple message the Republicans, generally the Republicans, are so good at, which is the emotional appeal.
You are exactly right, and your use of the word emotional is very important. And that's why I tell these stories, because I want you to have an emotional connection with what I'm trying to say. And you also are correct in having a simple message that you can get people to repeat so that it becomes the equivalent of a government takeover of the healthcare system. That's why I have used, we've had a Wall Street takeover of the healthcare system. You have to have something like that. What I have observed also, and Joe and I were talking about this last night, progressives, well, first of all, there is no structure for advocacy groups to do this. The insurers have AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. They, even though there's a diverse membership within that organization, Karen Ignani has become a master at message discipline and message dissemination, and part of that of the brilliance of that operation is getting others to getting allies to use the messaging that people like me used to create. They don't have to say this stuff, but they've got friends in the media and politics and business saying that stuff, and in a disciplined way. So that's why the support for this law has eroded. That's why people still believe it creates death panels. It's a very two-word phrase that scared the devil out of people. And a government takeover and socialized medicine. You are absolutely, these are short, memorable terms that pack an emotional wallop, and we need to do that. But we've got to figure out how can organizations come together and have that kind of discipline. It doesn't exist now. We've got to do that, or we're always going to be doing what we're doing now, which is spinning our wheels. It's vitally important. It has to be done in the structure. The thing that I have found, too, is that progressives are both arrogant and ignorant. They're arrogant in thinking that they've got truth on their side, so you just tell the truth and lay the facts out there and people are going to believe you and line up behind you. Well, we've seen evidence it doesn't work. I'm not advocating lying, but I'm saying pack the truth in a way that people will buy it or package it. And the other is an ignorance of how the special interests have been able to win and do what they do, and to figure out, well, if you're going to play with these guys, they pretty much have set the rules, so you've got to figure out how you can win the game using rules that they've set. You will not have the resources, but you've got lots of people. And there ought to, you know, there are some smart people too. We can figure this out, but we've got to do some things extraordinarily differently than we're doing it now. Yes, sir.
You have explained a lot of what this new federal law will do and some of what it will not do. I have been told that this law will reduce the cost of health insurance because everybody will have to pay into it. But of course, some people do not have the money to pay into it, even if the government tells them that they have to do it. I'm very concerned that under the control of Wall Street, as you point out so well, that the cost of health insurance will just continue to go up, as it has been to a large degree. And all of us, more than 70% of the American people who thought we should have had a single pay system, are going to be continuing to get more angry. Maybe that's what had to happen. But to do something incrementally, could we not just take a 1 year, maybe starting with the smallest children or with those that are almost ready to retire, and put more than just our seniors under the Medicare program, which is a far, far better program?
It's a good idea, but you'd never, ever get it through Congress. We live in a political world. The insurance companies will not allow that. That's why I keep going back to, I'm a realist. If you spend any time at all in Washington, you figure out pretty quickly that Republicans and Democrats are beholden to special interest. They are. And they will eventually vote for their own preservation to be reelected. They know that unless they are so secure in being reelected that the insurance industry and the special interests will throw money at their opponents. So that's, I'm talking about political reality here. It's a great idea, but it would never get through Congress right now because there is no abundant grassroots support expressing support for that. That's one thing. I know what you're saying. I would prefer that we could just tomorrow have a system in which everybody would be covered to try to get people to be able to afford coverage. The Act does provide subsidies to people, and if you currently can't afford to buy coverage, it'll be based on the sliding scale of what your income is. So a lot of people who don't have coverage now will have some subsidies that will help them pay for coverage. Now, it doesn't do enough to limit premium increases in years to come. That was something Congress was not able to achieve. The insurance industry was not going to let that happen, and they were successful. The best we could get is that any increases above, I think it's 10%, will be publicized. I mean, the Department of Health and Human Services, at least as long as Obama's president and Sebelius and whoever the president has as HHS secretary, make that public. And it's sort of like trying to embarrass these companies to make them justify why they need increases more than 10%. And they will have to be a lot more transparent, a lot more forthcoming than they ever have before. That's a big achievement. It's not nearly what we need, but it's the best we could get. It's better than where we are now, I'll put it that way. If you try to buy coverage on your own in this country, good luck with that, trying to figure out what is a good policy for you. And at least if this is implemented as Congress intended, you also will be able to make apples-to-apples comparisons between one plan and another. You'll be able to determine what kind of value you're getting from a health plan. You can't do that now. It's just hardly more than an educated guess. And if you work with an insurance broker, you may get some help there, but keep in mind, brokers get their money from insurance companies. Yes, sir.
Do you know about the experiment going on in Vermont and what that's about?
Yep.
What do you think of it?
Yes, I've been to Vermont a few times, and I've talked to the governor, Governor Shumlin, there. And what they have done, they have passed a law that puts them on the path toward a single payer system in Vermont. They can't get there right away because unfortunately the Affordable Care Act won't let them. They have to wait until I think 2017 before they can actually get to the real step of trying to implement a single payer system. So that's a long time between now and then. And the insurance industry will, you can rest assured, be throwing tons of money into Vermont to try to derail this from ever happening. But the current legislature and the governor is committed to this, as is the entire small congressional delegation of Vermont. So it is going forward. It has to work within the framework of the Affordable Care Act. It has to set up an exchange like every other state does. But they will use that sort of as a stepping stone towards single payer. Their exchange, for example, might have just two choices. And the state is setting up something called Green Mountain Care, which would ultimately be the single payer system. So it could be that it could be something like the Vermont version of a state-based public option that could be offered along with maybe one other private company. You have to have at least two, I think, on the exchange. So that would satisfy that. And then ultimately, it would go down to one, and there would be the single payer. The state would be the single payer. You would be covered by Green Mountain Care. You would still have private doctors and hospitals in private practice, and so it would not be a public delivery of health care, but it would be publicly financed and privately delivered care as it is in many other countries. So it's a step. I think that to get to single payer, if and when we do, it will probably be at the state level, as it was in Canada. You may know that it began in Saskatchewan in Canada, thanks to Tommy Douglas, the former Baptist preacher who got into politics and was just determined to make that happen, and he did. So you, as Margaret Mead said, you can get a few people who are determined to make something happen, as happened in Vermont. There was a small band of folks who were just obsessed with getting that done there. Vermont's unique. They were able to do it. But if they do it and it's demonstrated that it works, I think other states will look to Vermont as an example. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm hoping that you can comment on two recent events. One is the Occupy Wall Street phenomenon, set of protests around the country. And the other is the Obama administration's recent request to the Supreme Court that it review the Affordable Care Act and the individual mandate portion by election season of next year. I'm curious to know whether you can comment on, with respect to the first, whether you see any indication of the success or failure of our message, hoping that we can convince people to get upset, to get angry about the situation as it exists in this country, but you see the messages that you're carrying around the country reflected in the Occupy Wall Street movements or not, and what that suggests to you. And secondly, on the other portion of the Supreme Court, whether you can talk about what you see the future holding, depending on which way the Supreme Court goes.
I haven't heard many people outside of the Northeast talk about Occupy Wall Street all that much. I'm certainly not going to say it's not worth the effort to do it. I think it's probably a good thing. But it has to be part of a broader strategy to focus attention on just how much Wall Street has taken over our lives and how much we live in a plutocracy than a democracy these days. That's a mission of mine. It's something I'd like to do. I don't think you necessarily can do it by occupying Wall Street, but maybe that's a part of it. But it needs to be part of a broad strategy to do that. And I think you need to have people dressing up in my corporate drag, as I call it, doing the same kind of messaging. Because there are a lot of folks in this country who look at that and say, well, this is just a bunch of rabble-rousers, those are old hippies or a socialist, or, so they'll dismiss it. But so it needs to be part of a much bigger strategy to really effect change. With regards to the Supreme Court, I wasn't surprised that the administration asked the Justice Department to ask the Supreme Court to take this sooner rather than later. It's something that will there's no doubt this act is going to be a campaign issue in 2012. They're gambling that it's going to be upheld, I guess, or not. I don't know. We'll find out. I think it'll be upheld. I think that as the bill was being drafted, there were lawyers who are pretty familiar with the Constitution who worked on that to try to make sure that it was crafted in a way to withstand a constitutional challenge. I think it was understood that that would happen. Every big piece of legislation of social significance is always challenged. So this is no different from that. So there was attention paid to that. There was some sloppiness, though, as they were trying to rush it through, you know, get it done. There is no severability clause. There was no conference committee to try to iron out some of the differences between the House and Senate versions of the bill. So in that haste, some things were not done. I think, though, it's clear that Congress intended for there to be a severability clause. Some of the lower court rulings have been mixed. I think more, as I understand it, more court decisions have been in favor of the constitutionality of the law than have been against it. I think that, frankly, the insurance industry and its allies will support upholding it. They will either file an amicus brief or they'll have their buddies do it. And the Supreme Court is pretty political, folks. It's not immune to influence by special interest. And the insurance industry, in my view, is very, very influential and has very influential friends. So, you know, I'm saying that as if it should not be the individual mandate, but it does hang together with the individual mandate, and I think it will be upheld. We can, I think, overcome these guys, but we're going to have to do it the way that they win, and that is to develop a strategy, develop a communication strategy that supports the strategy, have message discipline, have figure out the best messengers. Your message is important, but just as important, if not more so, is how it's delivered and who delivers it. So it's got to be a well-thought-out strategic plan in which everybody understands, finally, that you got to work together and you got to work as a coordinated team, or we're always going to continue to be here getting slaughtered by these guys. Thanks.
You've been listening to former health insurance company head of communications, Wendell Potter, on Speaking in Maine. He spoke recently before a meeting of the Healthcare for Maine Alliance at the Maple Hill Farm Inn in Hollowell. If you missed part of the discussion or wish to share the program with a friend, it will be archived online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can stream the programs online or download as podcasts. A service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.